Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The United States is promising more transparency on the government's sometimes controversial use of drones to strike at terror targets. White House counterterrorism advisor Lisa Monaco promised today the administration will release an assessment in the coming weeks of both militant and civilian casualties due to drone strikes dating back to 2009. White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters today the U.S. considers the loss of life very carefully.
I can tell you that the Department of Defense applies the highest possible standard in avoiding civilian casualties before even deciding to move forward on an operation like this.
Earnest also says the release of drone strike data is consistent with President Barack Obama's commitment to transparency. It was a U.S. military strike on an al-Shabaab training camp in central Somalia that killed 150 militants preparing for a large-scale attack this weekend. VOA's Carla Babb reports.
The attack targeted an al-Shabaab training camp in Razo, about 190 kilometers north of the capital, Mogadishu. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis says the United States watched the camps and noticed the fighters were training for a large-scale attack.
And they were nearing the completion of that training. And we took action to ensure that they couldn't put that training to use.
The Pentagon used both manned and unmanned aircraft to carry out the attack on the al-Shabaab campsite. Initial assessments report no civilian casualties. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Turkey wants the European Union to double the aid it's giving to Ankara to deal with the migrant crisis, the European Parliament's president says. As EU representatives meet with their Turkish counterparts at a summit in Brussels this week, thousands of people are stranded at a border of Greece and Macedonia, waiting for help. This is VOA News. Tunisia's interior ministry said Monday troops killed 21 militants who attacked a police station in a military facility near the Libyan border. Officials said at least four civilians and one soldier were also killed in the fighting in the southeastern town of Ben Gurdain. At the U.S. State Department, spokesman John Kirby said the United States will stand with the Tunisian people against terrorism.
We share Tunisians' concerns about extremist activity, whether they're homegrown or external, and the threat that it poses to the country's stability and its prosperity.
Residents were urged to stay inside in Tunisia after the shooting began. South Korea and the United States have begun their annual joint military exercises in an atmosphere of increased tensions due to North Korea's latest nuclear and ballistic missile tests, as well as a threat from the powerful National Defense Commission of an all-out offensive to counter the annual drill. The North Korean news anchor reports that in response to any attack by U.S. and South Korean forces, quote, the North Korean army and people will not miss the opportunity to realize the greatest desire of the Korean nation through a sacred war of justice for reunification. They suggest they will launch an all-out offensive to decisively counter the United States and its followers' hysteric nuclear war moves. These annual exercises, known this year as Key Resolve and Full Eagle, are the largest ever staged, with more than 300,000 South Korean troops and about 17,000 U.S. forces participating. Meantime, Vice President Joe Biden kicked off a five-day trip to the Middle East on Monday as he expressed a U.S. mission to defeat ISIS, referring to the terrorist organization by its Arabic name.
We have to squeeze the heart of Daesh in Iraq and Syria, so they can't continue to pump their poison into the region and the rest of the world. And that's what we're doing with our coalition partners. We're hitting Daesh fighters and leaders harder than ever. We're making it harder for them to maneuver. We're cutting off their lifeline, their oil revenues, and their finances.
In speaking to U.S. military members at the airbase, he also infused a little bit of morale building.
You control the skies over Iraq and Syria. Matter of fact, you all control the skies of the whole damn world.
That seems a bit much, but Mr. Biden will also meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on Wednesday. On Thursday, he meets with Jordan's King Abdullah II. Russian tennis star Maria Sharapova says she failed a drug test at the Australian Open in January due to a substance she's been taking for 10 years for health reasons. She told a news conference in Los Angeles on Monday that the drug meladonium was added to the list of banned substances only at the start of this year, and she forgot to look at the updated ban list. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The USS's airstrike killed more than 150 Al-Shabaab fighters in Somalia.
The fighters who were scheduled to depart the camp pose an imminent threat to U.S. and African Union mission forces in Somalia. Their removal, the removal of those terrorist fighters, degrades al-Shabaab's ability to meet the group's objectives in Somalia.
That's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest. A hot debate is underway in Senegal over presidential term limit. Benin still awaits results from Sunday's presidential election. Petitioners challenging the re-election of Ugandan President Museveni won a small victory yesterday at the Supreme Court. And on this International Women's Day, we'll examine gender wage disparities.
At the global level, the employment gender gap has closed only by 0.6% between 1995 and 2015. This means progress getting women into more jobs either insufficient or has flatlined.
Lawrence Johnson is director of the International Labor Organization's Research Department, and the U.S. wants more African students to study at its universities. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States said Monday its airstrike in central Somalia has killed more than 150 al-Shabaab militants who were preparing for a large-scale attack on U.S. and African Union forces in Somalia. Here's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest.
The fighters who were scheduled to depart the camp pose an imminent threat to U.S. and African Union mission forces in Somalia. Their removal, the removal of those terrorist fighters, degrades al-Shabaab's ability to meet the group's objectives in Somalia, including recruiting new members, establishing bases, and planning attacks on U.S. and AMISOM forces. This is a good example of how the United States military can use our resources and capabilities in partnership with forces on the ground, in this case, African Union forces, to counter extremism and protect the United States and our interests. And so this is exactly the kind of counterterrorism strategy that the president has laid out. The last part of this is the Department of Defense is continuing to assess the results of the operation, so I can't confirm for you at this point the number of fighters who were killed in the operation or whether this had any impact on any civilians who may have been in the area. I can tell you that the Department of Defense applies the highest possible standard in avoiding civilian casualties before even deciding to move forward on an operation like this. So avoiding civilian casualties is a very, very high priority, both for moral reasons, but also because extremist organizations like al-Shabaab would just use the death of innocent civilians to try to recruit additional members and whip up additional anti-U.S. sentiment. So that's why the Department of Defense goes to great lengths to avoid that.
That was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest speaking during Monday's press briefing. Senegal's President Macky Sall has come under attack ahead of the country's constitutional referendum set for the 20th of this month. The proposed changes would limit a president to 2 5-year terms, but President Sall has stirred controversy by saying the limit would not apply to his current term, which runs until 2019. Alpha Diallo reports for VOA from the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
Campaigning is on in Senegal to vote V or no to the new constitution on March 20. In the Yes camp is the Minister of Youth and Employment, Mam Baye Niang. He met residents in Charoy, a low-income suburb of the capital. He says none of the proposed constitutional changes are to help the president. He says these changes are about strengthening democracy and the rule of law and improving quality of life. He says he just passed through a neighborhood where people were complaining they lost their land. These reforms will address those problems, he says, so you need to vote yes. The 15 proposed changes include giving more power to the National Assembly and local administration whilst also expanding on existing laws about land, inheritance and local communities' control of natural resources. but the proposal is meeting fierce resistance. That's the new single by rap group Yana Mar, calling on people to vote no in the referendum. Yana Mar played a leading role in demonstration against ex-president Ablai Ouad in 2012 when he ran for a third term at 87 years old. The group helped Macky Sall beat Ouad, but now is threatening more protests, this time against Sall. The group's coordinator, Fadel Barrow, says Macky Sall has failed to bring the big reforms he promised and instead just wants to make small changes that have nothing to do with the lives of ordinary Senegalese. He says Macky Sall went back on his word, and like all leaders who behave this way, he will pay a heavy price. The key dispute here is over the shortening of the presidential mandate. Sall has repeatedly promised, even before he was elected, to reduce his term from 7 to 5 years. But now that the provision is up for a vote, Sall says the new rule cannot legally apply to his current 7-year term. That explanation has not played well with some of his supporters, who say Sall broke his word.
Vous savez que le président Macky Sall avait fait une promesse au peuple sénégalais avant d'être élu.
Human Rights Campaigner Aboubakar Mbo says we are surprised that Sall changed his tune just a few weeks before the referendum. You know, in Africa, he says, promises are very strong and sacred. But Gibril Bande of the ruling coalition Benno Bokyakar says Sall is still making history.
Oui, moi je pense que en tant que militant des droits de l'homme, nous œuvrons pour la démocratie.
Bandi says this is really quite extraordinary and rare in Africa for an elected president to campaign in favor of reducing his potential term in office. Over the past 2 years, presidential term limits have become one of the burning issues on the continent. Efforts by leaders to extend their stays in office have led to unrest in the Republic of Congo and Burundi, and the ouster of longtime Burkina Faso President Blaise Compaoré in 2014. Alpha Diallo for VOA News, Dakar.
Vote counting continues in Sunday's Benin presidential election. The vote went on smoothly despite anticipated problems with election costs and other logistics. Civil society leader Rene Alapini Gansu tells Breaking Strike that as of late Monday, the presidential race looked like it would head to a second round with Prime Minister Lionel Zinsou as the front runner.
All the election has went very well, as well as possible with the election. From the beginning until the end of the election, we put out, maybe we faced maybe some small difficulties and so on, because maybe some place or center of vote has not opened on time, but at least it has been done very well. And somewhere, some people have just problem to know where they can, in which center they can go to vote and so on. But at least it has been resolved, because we conclude that 61% of the population went to deal with the election. Our declaration is saying that we went to the election as well as possible.
And there were 33 candidates up for the presidency, but the main leading candidate is Prime Minister Lionel Zinsou. What do you think that means for the country as a civil society leader?
Yes, I'm a leader of civil society, madam, but I don't have any position. The second thing is that, you know, we have more than 35 candidates, but at least if we can follow just the main candidates and so on, yes, the Prime Minister Zinsou Lionel has won an election, but at the beginning, politicians are saying to us, the Prime Minister will win just on the first round. But today, we all agree that we cannot go to just one round.
There will definitely be a second round then.
Yeah, second round it should, because we are getting slowly the result and so on.
Some of the big candidates, there are two big businessmen, and then you've got Zinsou, who is a former economist and investment banker. So do you think with those three all businessmen being some of the top candidates, that would indicate that the economy is the number one issue for the voters in Benin?
We Beninese, we will make our choice. If the prime minister is good for us, it's the decision of the population, the majority of the population. The civil society will be left time there to ask to Mr. Talon, if it is Talon who run on the next round, we will ask to his program.
Are you excited that there was, you know, the president had two terms and he decided to step down and there wasn't an issue of him running for a third term?
Mr. Yayi, maybe he's done the best he should be done. He finished to do his job. He did very well. And now it's time for him to step down. He will step down.
That was Rene Alapini Gansu, former chairperson of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights and a lawyer in Benin. She was speaking with Ricky Stryer from Cotonou. Today's Tuesday, March 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Banga in FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, Kirat FM in Jinja, Uganda, Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya, and Radio Hakoko in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is now coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. In Uganda, petitioners challenging the re-election of President Yoweri Museveni won a small victory yesterday, Monday, at the country's Supreme Court. The lawsuit is brought by former Ugandan Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi. The court agreed for his lawyers to make last-minute changes to his petition, which will compel the court to audit the results from the 112 districts in general and 28,010 polling stations in particular. Journalist Isaac Amaka is political reporter for the Uganda Daily Monitor newspaper. He says Mr. Mbabazi wants the court to order a recount in 45 districts because had the votes in those districts not been tampered with, President Museveni would not have won 60.7% of the vote, or the former prime minister would have got more than 1.4% of the votes cast.
Yesterday was the pre-trial conference where the lawyers from the two sides were meeting the judges to basically iron out whatever they wanted to put across before the main hearing starts. So before they would start, the counsel for Mr. Mbabazi, who is the petitioner in this case, informed the Chief Justice that they had amended the petition.
So what is the amendment they were trying to introduce?
The amendment was basically to introduce new prayers in the original petition, prayers which were not in the original petition. When the judges were ruling, they said that actually what had been filed in the new amendment was the core of the case. And they said that they would allow it to go on record because it was the crux of the matter that was going to be heard in court. But in this amendment, there are so many things that came up. But the most important one was actually that Mr. Mbabazi is planning to recount votes in 45 districts. Why is he doing this? He's doing this because he wants to put or to pass the substantiality test. This means that by recounting in 45 districts, in case the results of that recount show that there were glaring mistakes or that the votes were poorly counted, then would have substantially affected the outcome of the election. But why 45 districts? Because he's saying that during the voting, they introduced what they called the biometric voter verification kit. Those machines, a voter would go and put his or her thumbprint, and the photo would pop up, and then someone would go and vote. So Mr. Mbabazi is arguing for the disclosure and discovery of the data on those machines for each polling station and the data base of those machines at a national basis to prove that the number of voters declared by the Electoral Commission was materially different from the number of voters recorded on the biometric voter verification system. He further argues that the number of voters declared by the Electoral Commission included numbers of pre-ticked ballot papers stuffed at various polling stations and post-ticked and stuffed ballot papers in favor of candidate Yoweri Museveni. And they have picked up specific district, Kiruhura. Kiruhura, according to the Electoral Commission, voted 100%. And everyone in that district gave them 7. Like, there was no invalid votes. There was 100% voter turnout. And everyone who voted voted to become 7. So they are saying they want to see the machines from those districts to juxtapose what is the record on those machines and what did EC declare. But still, he argues that if these machines were working for 9 hours, which was the time for voting for one day, and each voter was allocated 2 minutes to vote, that could mean that that machine would only allow 270 voters per polling station, which would equal to 7.562 700 million voters nationally. So in the effect, that the 10 million voters that the Electoral Commission announced or declared as having voted would not have voted on the polling day.
Isaac Imaka is political reporter for Uganda's Daily Monitor newspaper. You're speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. The United States says it wants more African students to come to study at its universities. U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Industry and Analysis, Marcus Jodete, is leading the first ever education trade mission to Africa this week. Tuso Okumalo caught up with the delegation on Monday at their first stop in Johannesburg, South Africa.
University overcrowding, teacher strikes, and a lack of access to cutting-edge research opportunities can make it hard for even the most motivated of students to get ahead in Africa. But going overseas can be even harder. Of the 1 million international students who studied at the U.S. colleges and universities during the 2014 to 2015 academic year, less than 34,000 came from sub-Saharan Africa. The U.S. government wants to change that. Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Industry and Analysis, Marcus Jatot.
They should consider studying the U.S. because of the innovative approach to education that we take in the United States, because international businesses are looking for the best qualified, best prepared prospective employees, and we certainly believe that it enriches education back home in the U.S.
Jadot is traveling with representatives of 25 U.S. colleges and universities to recruit students and build partnerships with African universities.
Many of the universities who have traveled with us on this mission are including scholarships as a part of the conversation with students here as well.
His message attracted a long line of South African high school students. Bonemu Fukeng says he is hoping to go to law school at Michigan State University.
I want to see the world, and our country's economy is not that good. Maybe I can have a better life over there.
From South Africa, the delegation heads to Ivory Coast and Ghana. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Today is International Women's Day, an annual tradition began in 1908 and which focuses women's economic, social, political, and cultural achievements. The International Labour Organization reports that gender equality in the workplace remains elusive. A new ILO report, Women at Work, Trends 2016, finds that millions of women worldwide are not getting the same kind of quality, well-paying jobs as their male counterparts. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
New data in 178 countries present a gloomy picture of the current state of working women. The International Labour Organization's report shows the gender gap in employment, wages, and social protection has changed little in 20 years. The report notes significant progress has been made by women in education during the past two decades, but this has not translated into improvements at work. The data show women are less likely to participate in the labor market than men. ILO Research Department Deputy Director Lawrence Johnson says last year nearly 1.3 billion women were employed globally, compared to 2 billion men.
At the global level, the employment gender gap has closed only by 0.6% between 1995 and 2015. This means progress getting women into more jobs either insufficient or has flatlined.
The report shows women are more likely to be unemployed than men, and young women in particular are at a disadvantage. It says women continue to work longer hours per day than men in both paid and unpaid work. In high and low-income countries alike, it finds women on average carry out at least 2.5 times more unpaid household and caregiving work. Johnson says women are overrepresented in clerical service and sales work, which are among the lowest paying jobs.
Based on existing estimates, women earn less than their male counterparts. The gender wage gap is estimated at 23%. Though there has been some movement in reducing the gender wage gap, it will take, by the estimate, more than 70 years to achieve equality if all things are equal at this point.
Since women both work and earn less money, the report says they lose out in terms of social and retirement benefits. Globally, women represent nearly 65% of people who have reached retirement age without any regular pension. This, says the ILO, means some 200 million women are living without any regular income from an old age or survivor's pension, compared to 115 million men. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin the cycling. Rwanda will host the biannual 2018 African Continental Road Cycling Championship. The Rwanda Cycling Federation president, Aimable Bayingana, told the Kigali media on Monday. Bayingana says the Confederation of African Cycling confirmed Rwanda would stage the event during this year's championship, recently concluded in Casablanca, Morocco. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Cyprian Kotut clocked 1 hour and 1 minute to win the Paris Half Marathon in the French capital on Sunday. Fellow Kenyan Amos Kipruto was runner-up ahead of Ethiopian Asmerau Mengistu. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Dibaba Kuma prevailed in the women's race in 1 hour 9 minutes and 18 seconds, with Kenyan Pauline Wanjiku placed runner-up. In football, Egypt buried Libya under an avalanche of 8 goals without reply in their 2016 Women's Africa Cup of Nations qualifier played in Sousse, Tunisia on Sunday. Kenya got a bye to the next round following the withdrawal from the competition by their opponents at the Democratic Republic of Congo. In rugby, South Africa lies second in the overall standings after the 6th leg in the 9-leg IRB Sevens series that ended in Las Vegas, Nevada State in the United States of America on Sunday. South Africa has 86 points and are behind Fiji, who have 91, but ahead of the series defending champions New Zealand, who have 82 points. Kenya is 8th with 52 points, while Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. The next leg in the contest will be in Vancouver, Canada next weekend. Finally, in tennis, the 2-week ITF Confederation of Africa Junior Tennis Championship gets underway in the South African capital, Tshwane, today, Tuesday. The contest features players in the under 16 and under 14 age groups. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, March 8th.
Nigeria, where are we heading to? The naira is depreciating daily to dollar and pound. Economy is deteriorating daily, and a common man cannot have to buy anything again in the market. We are in dilemma. Ashibu Shir, from Obanuku, in Ogudu Cattle Ranch, Cross Water, Nigeria.
We thank you, listening for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.